Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Ivana Hughes. This is a project of BeatitudeCenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing peace and nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent, more peaceful world. So let's begin as usual with just a little prayer, and I invite you wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and relax and recenter yourself. And together let's enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the nonviolent Jesus here with us and take a moment to ask for whatever graces you need to be a peacemaker and to do the will of the God of peace. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to be peacemakers and to work for a more just, more nonviolent world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part, to help end war itself and poverty, racism, greed, injustice, and especially nuclear weapons and environmental destruction, that we might all be your holy peacemakers and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. Amen. So it's a great pleasure to welcome my friend Dr. Ivana Hughes, president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. Dr. Hughes is a senior lecturer in the discipline of chemistry at Columbia University in New York City. Dr. Hughes obtained her PhD from Stanford University, where she was an American Heart Association pre-doctoral fellow. She has been a faculty member at Columbia University since 2008 and was awarded the Lenfest Distinguished Columbia Faculty Award for 2020. Her work on ascertaining the radiological conditions in the Marshall Islands has been covered widely. She currently serves as a member of the Scientific Advisory Group for the United Nations to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, a committee consisting of 15 experts from around the world who advise the state parties on scientific issues as they pertain to the treaty. Her writings have appeared in The Nation, The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, The Hill, Scientific and American, Truthout, Common Dreams, The Diplomat, and elsewhere. Dr. Ivana Hughes, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Thank you so much, Father John. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be with you today.
Thank you. And thanks for all the great work you've been doing and your leadership for nuclear disarmament. I'm going to talk about that with you because I don't know anything about chemistry or the chem tables. And that makes me very scared even thinking about it. But you are the president of one of the premier organizations in the world advocating for nuclear disarmament, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, which people can learn about at www.wagingpeace.org. So let's just jump right into that, Ivana. Tell us about the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation.
Absolutely, John. So, Father John, so the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation was founded in 1982, so we're nearing our 43rd birthday or anniversary. It was founded by really a few visionary people, including David Krieger, who was a longtime president of the foundation and who passed away in 2023, and Frank A. Kelly. This was a group of people who realized that in the nuclear age, peace wasn't just a moral imperative. It was actually an existential imperative. And so they wanted to form an organization that would be, in some sense, flexible in the way in which it would approach these issues, but also really stay true to the goal, the vision of a world free of nuclear weapons. And so over the decades, the mission has really remained the same. I took the helm of the foundation in 2022 and essentially didn't change anything about what we aim to do, which is to educate and advocate for a just and peaceful world, one that is free of nuclear weapons, as far and wide as we possibly can. And so over the decades, there have been a number of initiatives that NAPF either was a part of or had spearheaded, including, I'll just mention a few of them, the Waging Peace series, which in the early years, the early decades, sort of brought to the fore some of the issues that are so specific to the nuclear age as a whole and to nuclear weapons, in particular. The Foundation was also engaged in efforts such as the Middle States Power Initiative. This was a kind of international effort to bring those states that do not possess nuclear weapons but still have a kind of clout in the world to advocate for disarmament. There was another initiative which we called the Nuclear Zero Lawsuits. This was in the 2010s, working with the government of the Republic of the Marshall Islands. You actually mentioned that I have done scientific research on trying to understand the radiological conditions in the Marshall Islands, which were, and many in your audience might know this, the site of U.S. nuclear testing from 1946 to 1958. But in the 2010s, the Republic of the Marshall Islands decided that they wanted to actually sue nuclear-armed states, not for what had actually happened during the nuclear testing period, but for their failure to disarm, which is actually an obligation of in particular, five nuclear weapons states that are recognized by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so that was another initiative. And more recently, since I took the helm of the foundation, we've really been very focused on multilateral processes at the United Nations. You mentioned the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and I'll be happy to speak about it in a little bit more. But we try to bring disarmament into, and in particular nuclear disarmament, into other fora, including United Nations General Assembly, including other disarmament meetings like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as well as really a whole host of kind of discussions that take place at the UN around issues like sustainability, the health of our oceans, information and communications technologies. So many of these issues actually have links to the fundamental problem of having weapons in our world that are quite simply capable of destroying it. And so that has really been, our focus again over the decades and and really something that I'm very, very much committed to in my still fairly, young presidency and leadership of the foundation.
Yes, thank you. It's very hard to talk about nuclear weapons and the possibility and reality of nuclear war, but I think we have to, and having you here is a great gift. We're closer than ever before to nuclear war. We continue to spend trillions maintaining and building these weapons instead of using those funds for justice and the needs of the global poor. So I want to ask you briefly to talk from your perspective about the threat of nuclear war today, late 2025.
I think the threat is absolutely enormous. I think this is something that could not just happen quite literally tomorrow or next week or next month or in a year, but something that would also happen, I think it's so important for people to know and recognize this, that would happen in a matter of minutes. Actually, next week, Netflix will release a new film by Catherine Bigelow, the Oscar-winning film director, called The House of Dynamite, And I encourage everyone who has a chance to see it, because it describes a scenario that makes it very, very clear that nuclear war is the kind of existential threat that's going to take place in a matter of minutes. I think of course, you recall the days of the, in the 80s and the very, very heightened nuclear arms race. At the time, there were on the order of 70,000 nuclear warheads, most of them in the possession of the United States and the Soviet Union. And of course, it was an extremely dangerous time. In fact, many people who've sort of studied and looked at the history of the nuclear age really believed that we, for the most part, we actually just got really lucky. The nuclear war never happened. There were many, many close calls. But that of course, led to, by the end of the 80s and early 90s, the collapse of the Soviet Union, huge nuclear arms reductions, agreements between the United States and Russia and so on. And we are currently at 12,500 nuclear warheads, which is, of course, a whole lot better than 70,000, but still enough to destroy the world over and over and over again. And what I think is really key to recognize is that the dynamics have actually changed. It is no longer just a Cold War between two superpowers. There are today 9 nuclear armed states, 5 of them, again, recognized by the United Nations as nuclear weapons states. That's United States, Russia, United Kingdom, France, and China. And then 4 others that possess nuclear arms, which is Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. And that's a lot more. As I said, the U.S. and Russia still have most of the world's largest arsenals, and it's estimated at about 90% of the world's arsenals. But it is a lot more complex of a playing field when you have 9 states possessing these weapons, some which are real, hardcore adversaries. We saw just this year, India and Pakistan literally on the verge of war and the word nuclear war, being openly discussed, as it has been since the onset of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. And, of course, the Middle East conflict, where we're thankfully celebrating some good news this week. And I'm, keeping my fingers crossed that this continues on the same trajectory. In the Middle East, we have Israel, which also has nuclear weapons, and we saw all that happened that took place between Israel and Iran, as well as the United States, in earlier this year. So it's a very challenging time. It's often described that in United Nations, lingo, as a challenging security environment. And I think, often when I try to speak to leaders, diplomats, and so on, I get answers like, well, now is not a time for disarmament. And my answer is actually now is precisely the time for disarmament, because now we see that we see how easily these weapons could end up being used in times of conflict, in times of heightened tensions, in times when maybe you think you're being attacked, maybe you're not even under attack, but you think you are, and you end up using one of these weapons. And what we do know is that when you use one, it doesn't end there. It goes all the way to a full-blown nuclear war, which would have hundreds of millions of people dying from the explosions themselves, and then billions more from the aftermath of the explosions, from things like nuclear winter and ozone layer destruction and radiation and so on. So this is quite simply not, you know, it's like playing, there are people who refer to this as nuclear roulette, you know, just sort of continuing to play this game without recognizing that actually humanity cannot coexist with nuclear weapons.
Thank you. Yes.
Definitely.
It's an existential threat, as you said.
Absolutely.
But one
Absolutely.
Of the great signs of hope in the whole world right now, and where there are, seem to be so few, is, I think, the United Nations Treaty, the Treaty to Ban Nuclear Weapons, which you are actively a part of. And
yes.
So I would love you to tell us all about the treaty and what it means, what's the latest news, what the strategy is. You know that Martin Sheen and I were the keynote speakers at the launching of it for
yes.
the International
yes.
Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons
yes.
in Oslo in 2012. It's one of the greatest experiences of our lives. And they were saying, so we're going to the UN and we're going to have a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. And we laughed.
yeah.
And everything this, the great, great leaders from around the world told us in Oslo is coming true. So tell us about yeah. it. I mean, take your time.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited about this. I really wasn't a part. This was when you were in Oslo in 2014. It was just when I was beginning to be interested in nuclear weapons. But it just tickles me to no end to know that you were both there. And we actually have to get you back now. Now you have to help us bring the treaty to really accomplish and reach all of its goals, which is the total elimination of nuclear weapons. So let me just say a few words about how the treaty started. It started with this effort to highlight the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons, to really focus on what nuclear weapons do to people, as opposed to these sort of policy discussions about nuclear deterrence and security and so on and so forth. And that led to negotiations, which were really primarily led by a group of states from the global south, including some notable exceptions from Europe, like Austria and Ireland, and a few others. But what it has been is in 2017, this treaty was negotiated without the nuclear weapon states in the room. And it was negotiated to really just ban anything and everything having to do with nuclear weapons. And the treaty then entered into force. The negotiations were in July of 2017. It was open for signatures of states in September of 2017. And then it entered into force in January of 2021. So this was just in the midst of the global pandemic. Over 50 states by that point had not just signed, but also ratified the treaty. And we currently just recently reached 99 states, UN member states, that are either, they have either ratified the treaty, that means their legislative bodies have basically now committed to adhering to everything that the treaty spells out in legal terms. And then in a small group of states are also signatories and are working towards ratification. So that's a total of 99 ratifying and signatory states. And the treaty, again, has, you know, provisions for elimination of nuclear weapons. It bans other kinds of activities having to do with nuclear weapons, including, for example, threatening to use nuclear weapons, which is something that, as I said, we currently see and have seen, especially over the last few years. And the treaty also, very importantly, has provisions that are referred to as humanitarian provisions to assist victims and remediate environments impacted by nuclear weapons use and nuclear weapons testing. And so this is, an international treaty, an agreement among states that currently has more than one half of all UN member states supporting it. And it's a process that will continue, for a number of years, for really however long it takes to eliminate nuclear weapons. And my view is that we are never going to actually have another treaty that brings everyone to the table. And that's really what you need. You need a treaty that's going to have everybody agree to the fact that these weapons have no place in our world. Of course, the challenge now is to bring those states that possess nuclear weapons to the table. And this is what so many people, both in the diplomatic world, but also in civil society, are working on. How do we bring other states? One of the things that the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation has been doing on this front is really sort of using and thinking about the humanitarian provisions of the TPNW and using them as a kind of avenue to engage states in discussions about disarmament and to bring them to the table. And we've done a very good job working with some of the states on this.
Let me ask you about the strategy and the goal. And you tell me if I'm right. I mentioned this to you when I saw you a few weeks ago. So this goes back to when we were in Oslo, because we didn't quite know what we were entering into there. And here we are meeting these prestigious diplomats, the leading global visionaries and advocates for nuclear disarmament. And it's the launch of the humanitarian campaign, as you said, and ICAN, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. But behind it were all the people who had banned landmines in the 90s, who had brought Princess Diana in. Now, the whole world knows that story, but you can't get rid of landmines. There's no treaty. You can't do that. And these people, as I understand it, now here's my take on this, why this is so important. They just decided in Norway in the 1980s, now we're going to get rid of landmines. That's the way. And here's how we're going to do it. We're going to come up with a treaty, and we're going to get everybody in the world who doesn't have landmines to sign it. Until we slowly come up to the last, 20 nations in the United Nations, and we shame them into it. And it was during that part in the 1990s that Diana got involved. And then if you weren't against nuclear weapons, landmines. You certainly changed very quickly. And so then these same people go, okay, we got rid of landmines. And, the cleanup continues. Now we're going to take on cluster bombs. And you go, well, you can't get rid of cluster bombs. And they did the same thing. And there we were in Oslo, and these same people were telling Martin Sheen and me, and so now we've decided to take on nuclear weapons. So as I understand it, Ivana, the strategy is, and we couldn't even imagine this 13 years ago, they were saying we're going to get 150 nations of the world to sign a treaty at the United Nations totally outlawing nuclear weapons. And then you have the five nuclear powers, but there's actually nine, as you said.
Nine,
and we're going to shame them into signing and get rid of nukes. And this is going to work. And I remember so many times Martin Sheen and I looked at each other. We were like, well, good luck with that. And here you're telling me that just in the last few weeks, 99 nations have signed it.
Yeah.
And like everything they said they were going to do 13 years ago is playing out. It's on track. Is that a good take on the whole situation?
It's an excellent description. I would just say that it was actually a new group of people focusing on nuclear weapons, but saying, well, not completely new. There's certainly some overlap, but a lot of actually very young people.
Yes.
And you probably remember that.
Yeah, I do remember
them.
So
some of them weren't even old enough to be around for the landmines.
Yeah.
But they were inspired by the custom munitions. But they were inspired by it. And it is this recognition that even if you don't have a certain kind of weapon, you have the power inside the United Nations, inside the international community, to say no.
And so,
this is wrong.
Right.
And what's even more so true for the nuclear weapons, because what I stated wasn't an exaggeration, that nuclear weapons would quite literally, nuclear war could kill billions of people. It's the recognition that these states that don't have these weapons wouldn't even be attacked by the weapons, but would absolutely collapse and be destroyed, and their people would be dying and starving to death and exposed to radiation, recognizing that actually your weapons threaten all of us, and
yes,
that's not okay.
I'm so glad you brought up the young people, because so many of them were from Scandinavia and Europe, but also other places, not
Australia,
but not from the United States. And their perspective was so
different.
Generally.
Now we're there.
I know.
We're absolutely there. And I should say one other group of people have been people who've been impacted by nuclear weapons, starting, of course, with the Hibakusha from Japan, the survivors
of course,
of the atomic bombings
yes.
of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also what we refer to as affected communities from places like the Marshall Islands.
Yes, of course.
And the Republic of Kiribati and French Polynesia and Australia and Kazakhstan and Algeria. I mean, the list is endless. Also here in the United States, the downwinders from the American Southwest.
Yes.
But really, all of the United States was exposed to radiation fallout from the Nevada test.
It's a
huge community of people who really just see these weapons as immoral and as the ultimate threat. And just to connect to what you were saying about landmines and cluster munitions, with nuclear weapons, again, these are weapons of mass destruction. And the other two types of weapons of mass destruction, the biological weapons and chemical weapons, have both been outlawed. The United States, just in the last year or so, actually destroyed its last stockpile of chemical weapons. We had chemical weapons up until a year or so ago. And we've destroyed them. And it's the nuclear weapons absolutely have to be treated with that same recognition.
That's great. Thank you.
That this is
yes.
just not acceptable.
Well, see, that's very, very hopeful and good news. And that's why I want everyone to know about the treaty. And also in this kind of hopeless time, there's a lot of hope there. I was just going to make a little comment that the young people we met in Europe brought a new energy that I hadn't really seen in the United States, like in decades, where they just felt this is doable and we're going to do it. And I hope that can become contagious among young people in the U.S.
Absolutely. And I really would love to have you and Martin come to New York next year when we will have the TPNW first review conference.
Yeah.
That will be in November of next year. If you can come and see the energy and see the commitment and talk to people who've been personally affected by these weapons or their, families have been, and talk to diplomats working every day to ensure that we can get to a world free of nuclear weapons, I think you would really love it. Because now we're at a whole new stage and phase of this effort.
Let me ask you about yourself.
Going forward.
Because we're running out of time here. You had this very big, busy life with your family and postdoctoral chemistry research at Columbia and your teaching, and you're the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. You're living there in Manhattan, running back and forth to the UN and then to Geneva and then to Oslo and Colombia. How do you maintain peace and balance and hope? Where do you find strength these days to keep going forward?
Oh, it's a great question. I think I have a really, in some sense, a heightened sense of having been very privileged. You read my biography, and I grew up in former Yugoslavia. I was very fortunate to come to the United States and get to study here at some of the world's best universities. And as a scientist, I really feel very compelled to contribute to this effort because, you know, sadly, it was scientists and science that brought nuclear weapons to our world. And I strongly believe that scientists have to be a part of the solution, which is to get rid of them. I'm also, you mentioned my family. I'm a mother. I have three. I mean, two of my children are young adults. My daughter is 24. I have a son who's 20. And I have one in high school who's still 14. And, you know, as a mother, I would want nothing more than to leave them a world free of nuclear weapons. Anything else, you know, if I can leave them something else in addition, great. But if I can be sure that they can continue to live in a world that is not, you know, potentially minutes away from total and complete destruction, that would just be everything for me.
Thank you.
And I work with young people, and that's really where I find hope and inspiration and a kind of commitment to keep going at this until we get the job done.
So many of our listeners have been involved in the nuclear disarmament movement and peace movements. But for folks who are listening today, what suggestions would you have about where they can go to learn more about it, or what actual concrete steps they can take to support the UN treaty ban, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, or efforts in general for nuclear disarmament? What can people do?
Absolutely. That's a great question, John. And it's a question that we get all the time. I mean, I think for members of the audience who really do understand the issue, you know, that's fine. And you can always learn more. I am amazed by, you know, how dedicated I feel I have been to the issue, and yet how much I can literally learn every single day, whether it has to do with the history or the science and or whatever. And if you aren't, if you're new to this topic, just learn, I think is absolutely key. And people just talking about this and this being part of our everyday conversations. And then there are, of course, our elected representatives. And contacting them and contacting the White House, I think under any administration, is absolutely key. Our elected representatives need to know that the general public cares about this issue. And we've spoken, I've gone to D.C. Many times, and we speak with mostly with staffers, occasionally with actual elected representatives, but when we speak with them, we learn that they don't need to hear from 1,000 people that this is important to them. They need to hear from 10 people. You know, so it's not a big number, but if you care, you need to let them know. People can support local initiatives. There are local organizations that try to kind of do this at the grassroots level, and you can have sort of, you know, city resolutions or other kinds of divestment efforts, for example, that are local in nature and maybe kind of easier to tackle, and supporting, you know, organizations that specifically work on disarmament, whether at the national or international level. And then just a recognition that really everyone can contribute. If you're an artist, make art about this. If you're a doctor, point out that you couldn't do your job, you know, in the aftermath of a nuclear war. Scientists, media, celebrities, teachers, everyone really has some way of making, you know, this topic central to how we go forward, because on the one hand, if we destroy the world, then none of the other issues we care about are going to matter. And on the other hand, until we actually stop investing, not just in weapons of mass destruction like nuclear weapons, but other types of you know, military and war-making machines and et cetera, we're not going to be able to address other challenges that we have that require, you know, people to cooperate across nations and so on.
Well, our time is up. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we end, Ivana?
No, I mean, I just really loved speaking with you. And I think, again, just to bring us back to the 1980s when there was this upswelling of general public's engagement and involvement in this issue. This is what we need today. We need once again to come together and tell our leaders that enough is enough. 80 years of the nuclear age it has been more than enough. And we need to bring this issue to an end.
Thank you so much, Ivana Hughes, for speaking with me today and for encouraging everyone to step up and keep the conversation going. And we can all do what we can for nuclear disarmament. And thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming programs at beatitudecenter.org. Please consider offering a donation to support this free work. And if you can, please leave some positive feedback or review at the National Catholic Reporter or Apple or Spotify or YouTube or whatever platform you use. And please help spread the word about the Nonviolent Jesus podcast by telling friends everywhere about this. You can see a full list of all past programs, podcasts, and upcoming podcasts at www.beatitudecenter.org. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus, and see you next time.